These are some introductory comments on two texts written by the political scientist James C. Scott. The first text that I gave you to look at is Against the Grain. That's a very recent book by him, 2018, 2019, maybe. And the other passage, the denser one, is taken from The Art of Not Being Governed, which is a text that Scott published maybe in 2013 or 2014. I think it's a beautiful book and well worth reading. In our context, I offer these texts as I will offer the texts for the next week, the Clastris and Uchelon, as a sort of way to bracket our approach to classical political theory. So here's my thinking. When we study classical political theory in our tradition, in these American schools, but also all through Europe and even in the world that was colonized by Europe, what is meant is typically ancient Greek and Roman political theory. That's important stuff. Definitely, this tradition is very much rooted in those things. And yet, of course, there are problems with a colonial tradition, a Western tradition, defining itself, identifying itself in terms of this historical lineage, rooting itself in ancient Athens and often even in a democratic tradition, which is said to originate with ancient Athens. It is not true that democracy originated in ancient Athens. Democracy has existed all over and all around the world prior to European colonization and outside of the major state and civilization forms with which we are familiar. So I want to correct this Western Eurocentric view, which is a difficult thing to do in a class which is specifically set up to look at ancient Greece and Rome. So we're going to look at ancient Greece and Rome, but also beyond them. And the Scott texts today are supposed to guide our gaze beyond this Eurocentric and civilization-centric focus that we usually have when we look at the classical. Now, why look at classical theory at all? The answers to that are simple to an extent. One answer is that, well, medieval political theory, modern political theory, Renaissance political theory before that, and then modern political theory right up to the present, makes use of the same concepts, the same terms, the same language, the same traditions, the same lines, the same evolutions of thought and dichotomies and oppositions as are already present in Plato. So we look at classical political theory in order to understand contemporary political theory. It's like an elementary study which gives us the pieces and the forms that are going to be deployed and redeployed, configured and reconfigured for 2,500 years afterwards. That's how we're supposed to think about it. Anyway, I think it's important to recognize that when we look at classical political theory, we don't just do it for the sake of old wisdom. We do it for the sake of present wisdom. When we read Plato, if we're doing it in an intelligent way, we have to be thinking about whether he is right or wrong about us, about the structure of our souls, about the structure of our cities and our society. That's the only reason that Plato matters, is if his work bears upon the experience and the situation in which you find yourself. So we look at classical political theory as an original, although I'll suggest it's not original, a traditionally central reservoir of political concepts, political possibilities, and the elements of political analysis. Famously, in Plato, in Aristotle, and then repeated for centuries up through Machiavelli, up into the moderns, one of the things that you can find in this early tradition is a typology of possible political systems. You'll find in Plato, Aristotle, Machiavelli will repeat it. It occurs in centuries after that, that there are basically 3 to 6 forms of government depending on how you count. There's monarchy, there's aristocracy, and there's a good democracy, and then there's corrupted forms of these. There's tyranny, there's oligarchy, and there's the corrupted democracy. So that's one of the things that we really need to be paying attention to. The classical tradition and the political theory universe of which it is a part and into which we are folded through classes and texts takes these sets of possibilities largely for granted. And one of the things that we are supposed to learn in looking at this old stuff is the range of possibilities for political configuration. So I offer you James C. Scott as a starting point, and then Pierre Clastres and Abdullah Öcalan as starting points to reconfigure, to broaden our notions of what is really possible, what is really natural, what is really desirable, what is civilized, and so on. So I think James C. Scott as a starting point can be used in order to broaden and reset our perspective with respect to political possibilities in at least 2 ways. The first text, Against the Grain, is a, as he says, a long history, a very long history, which looks at the entirety of the duration of the species of Homo sapiens sapiens. The history arguably even goes before that. We can look 400,000 years back and say that's about the time that hominids began using fire in order to change their environment. Scott thinks that changed the history of the planet. 200,000 years or thereabouts is the lifetime of Homo sapiens sapiens, of us. So Scott wants us to rethink that very long history and to recontextualize the present configurations. The word that he uses is social organization or social structures that we inhabit presently in the light of what humans have been and how humans have lived for the majority, the vast majority of their real history. The primary narrative which most people accept, whether they go through college for political science or not, maybe even especially if they do, whether they go for a PhD in this or related fields or not, and maybe especially if they do, the primary stories that we have to challenge are stories about progress and civilization. So we are taught from the time we show up in school until the time we die that history has been progress, that something more and more complex, better and better, offering higher and higher standards of life, involving higher and higher cultural expressions, involving more and more sophisticated and allegedly efficient systems of governance, that this process of change has been going on for 6,000 years or so. Now remember, Homo sapiens sapiens have been around for 200,000 years, which means that 194,000 years of the history of human beings, or more if you recognize our close proximity to the other hominids, 500,000 years of history are all to be dismissed as primitive, barbaric, inconsequential, and unrelated to real humanity. Now, that's a bit awkward, right? This is all because we have this idea about progress, and we also have this idea about civilization, because major changes happened to the human species, one of them about 12,000 years ago, another one about 6,000 years ago, and a last one only 150, 200 years ago. These major changes, the first of which is the shift from the so-called Paleolithic to the Neolithic, the beginning of sedentary societies and village-based societies. And supposedly, although Scott really wants to point out this story is incorrect, supposedly fixed-field agriculture goes along with the becoming sedentary of peoples, goes along with the establishment of enduring villages, moves towards the establishment of larger cities, and supposedly coincides with the institution of hierarchical state structures. Now, he wants to attack that particular story, right? So, okay, shift one, Paleolithic to Neolithic, shift two, from the Neolithic village to the state structure, so the early civilizations, the Tigris and Euphrates in Mesopotamia, somewhat later civilization along the Yellow River in China. That's shift number two, into the state form, which we have been taught is natural to humans, but which empirically, well, it's, what does he say, about 2.5% of the history of humans has been lived in any kind of connection with the state form. And for the vast majority of the existence of state forms, state societies, by which I mean societies that have a striation, they have a distinction between a smaller group of people who have decision-making powers and typically live off the surplus product of the larger portion of the population who have no decision-making powers, often historically have been enslaved, and produce such that the ruling class is able to rule and doesn't have to work. Those societies, even though they began 6,000 years ago, were not the dominant form of human life until recent centuries. So the shift to the existence of states at all is one major shift, and then the most recent one is industrialization, the beginning of the use of fossil fuels. These are major shifts in the way that humans occupy the planet. So as we're looking at the possibilities for how humans can organize themselves, and we're looking at these basic questions about what is human nature and what is human structure and what is a good human versus a bad human and how does this relate to the polis? What is the polis? What is the political unit? What is the natural or the desirable political unit or set of units into which humans are best organized? Now, already with the Greeks, there is this fundamental distinction made between civilization and barbarism. The word barbarian is a Greek word. It's a word that basically meant blah, blah, blah. Barbar is how non-Greek languages sounded to Greek speakers. They spoke as if people outside the Greek world didn't even speak language, weren't even entirely human. The Greeks, as we will see in Plato's Republic, had different rules of warfare and rules regarding enslavement with respect to Greek people versus non-Greek people. This distinction between civilization and barbarism is as old as civilization, possibly. And yet, the idea that civilization, living in this hierarchical format with fixed living conditions, rule of law, taxation, standing armies, slave-based labor, surplus production, cereal grains, this whole picture, we're told that this is real human life and everything else is not political. As if these peoples who were called barbarians by the Greeks were less intelligent, were more animal-like, and that their societies were backwards, a part of some dark prehistory that we really don't need to think about, that it is nothing. So recontextualization, number one, that I hope Scott will inspire in us, is a rethinking of the story of progress and the story of civilization. We need to ask again whether these shifts that we're talking about are necessarily just plain natural, evolutionary, for the best, or if maybe they could have gone otherwise and did go otherwise at different places. So one, we need to reconsider historically what we're thinking about when we look at the classical. The Greeks are not really at the beginning of anything. The Greeks continue Persian and Egyptian thought in all kinds of ways. The mathematics of the Greeks were first Egyptian mathematics. The dualisms of the Greeks were first of all Persian dualisms. The religious rites that were practiced by the Greeks don't just originate with the Greeks. The Dionysian cult that we'll look at came from Syria. So the Greeks are not the beginning of anything. I mean, there is this beautiful, prolific cultural production in that particular place, right? And I think Plato is a joy to read and really makes you think. But this is not to say that Plato stands at the very beginning of human thought, which is kind of what I was taught in studying the history of philosophy. That's just not true. And so as we investigate, what are the real types? What are the basic options? What are the possibilities for political organization? And specifically, as we ask questions about community, its nature, its scope, its characteristics, and democracy, you know, whether and how it is desirable, we need to think back before the Greek moment, back before civilization, and recognize that humans have lived for a very long time, and they have been political creatures. This is Scott's position, and Clastra's position, and Uchelon's position. They have been political creatures for that entire time. Politics is not born, according to this account, in ancient Athens. So this is the first recontextualization that Scott gives us that we really need to think about. And he offers challenges to the basic story. So, you know, the idea is that once people understood that they could farm, then they became sedentary in order to be with their fields. And once they were sedentary, the most natural and efficient form of administration was the hierarchical state structure. So Scott really wants to challenge that, and he points out that this story is false. It's told all the time, but it's false. There were sedentary societies that existed for millennia in places where there was no fixed field agriculture. There were fixed fields, places where domestic crops were grown on a regular basis for centuries, but no sedentary population. There were still nomad populations that tended these fields as they passed by in their nomadic circuits. Even the idea that sedentary life, having a fixed abode with your name attached to it and all that, is clearly superior to nomadic hunter-gatherer life is something that needs to be questioned, because there are people in historic memory, he gives the example of the Sioux and the Comanche, who were nomadic people, and even as they were pressured, militarily pressured, to become sedentary, they refused. And it's not that they refused everything. They adopted technologies and trading techniques, and specifically, notably, horses, which changed the whole character of the nomadic culture. They accepted changes, but they rejected and militarily resisted sedentarization, being made to live in one place. Scott says they associated living in one place and in these dense city-like situations with disease and slavery. And they were right to do so, because those are the things that existed in those places. Okay, so we need to rethink whether the contemporary forms that we have and that are in certain ways initiated or clarified in the classical moment in ancient Greece, whether those are necessarily the only options or the best options. We have to look at this tradition, but we also have to look outside the tradition. And then the second thing that he offers in The Art of Not Being Governed, which I think, you know, I offer to you as something to reflect on, is that the distinction between civilization and barbarism is problematic as well. And the social organization which exists in the field called primitive or barbaric, whatever is outside the major civilizations with their roads and their monumental construction and their writing and their taxation and their militarization, the outside of these large assemblages, which are often empires, has been called by these empires systematically, whether we're in China, Southeast Asia, the Middle East, the Mayan world, the outside of these civilizations has been called barbarism or primitivism. And there's often this thought that, I mean, primitive means, you know, primary, like it's a beginning point. Development, which is natural, has not yet occurred with respect to the primitive. It's placed historically earlier and historically early enough as to be basically insignificant. But Scott's point here is that actually this is incorrect as well. People become barbaric and primitive over and over. Now, his real area of specialization is Southeast Asia, and specifically this territory of Southeast Asia, bigger than the United States, I think, that is referred to as Zomia, mountainous territory overlapping 7 or 8 nation states, which is arguably the longest unruled portion of the globe. There have been state enterprises on the periphery of Zomia, and there have been statelets, little state enterprises that pop up and then disappear in Southeast Asia for thousands of years. And this is Scott's study. Right. So what he wants to show is that the primitive barbarian style of life and the civilized state way of life actually have always existed together. They need to be understood, he says, in a dialectical relationship. And this is something that we'll come back to a lot, because we're going to look at these societies which are outside, well, outside the pale is one of the technical terms for it, I think, that are outside the state-controlled, legible, appropriable, managed, lawful, and orderly society. There has always been such a fringe to state societies. And state peoples have actually fled state circumstances in order to become again barbarian or primitive. So we need to recontextualize and rethink our distinctions between civilization and barbarism. One of the positions that Scott takes, which I appreciate, is that social organization is not just like an evolutionary fact that happens to us naturally. This is like a very, you know, Hegelian sort of idea about progress, but it's a choice. Social organization is a choice. And this brings us back also to the question of political possibilities. From what range can these choices be made? Social organization is a choice, and the choice of the peoples living outside the state, and these are typically hill peoples. This is the whole art of being art of not being governed is largely a study of hill peoples. Zomia is hill country, right? You can find outsider, sort of more backwards, less governed peoples many places where there are hills or other inaccessible geographies. People run away from control. And they also sometimes go back to the state when the state has something to offer, when there's a disease, when circumstances make it desirable to go deal with these rulers in order to get the benefits they might be able to provide. People do that too. There is a respiration between the outside and the inside, between the state form and the outside of the state forms. And they have persisted through this whole history. So the barbaric and the primitive are really not archaic, not primitive. They are an option. And I think if we look outside that civilized state focus, which everybody looks at, then we will find all kinds of forms of things that we might also call democracy. And then we can get a really different view on the venerability, the age, the antiquity, the classicality of democracy than we can if we just look inside the tradition. Then we are going to be bound by what people like Plato and Aristotle and so on have to say about the options. You know, even if the moderns are going to evaluate representative democracy, which I think is a contradiction in terms, they're going to represent democracy in a more positive way. They're still thinking inside the range of options that we can find expressed in Plato and Aristotle. So we don't want to get stuck in that way. We need to have a long historical view and to understand the contingency of recent civilizational and state developments. And we also need to have a broader spatial view where we don't just look at the centers of high society, but also at the fringes where people live very differently. So we can understand certain forms of social organization as being preferred by the state and hierarchical society, which is oriented towards surplus production, always involves an upper and a lower class, and the exploitation of the lower class by the upper class to allow it to live through and through the control of a surplus. So we should think differently now. We should recognize that some forms of social organization are desirable for the state. Even tribes, which we often think of as a preliminary form of social organization pre-existing larger social structures, according to Scott and according to a number of the other authors that we'll look at, are typically constructed by state enterprises, by colonizing enterprises, because the state needs a static entity. It needs there to be these clearly defined and static and immobile groupings of people so that it can control them. If there is no tribe, if there's just this kind of perpetual slur and intermingling of the non-state peoples, which I think is what Scott thinks really exists outside of the state cores, then there's nothing for the state to hold on to. The state has to name people, it has to ethnically codify people, and then it also has to give them leaders. It has to identify leaders among them, because it can't be negotiating with the entirety of a population. It has to have its ambassador talk to somebody who's in charge. So there needs to be somebody in charge. So these ideas about like the tribe with the chief, these kind of, Disney pictures of what primitive life is like, is not they're not quite correct either, because actually even those forms correspond to state and colonial grasping of non-state peoples. So what is there over on this non-state side? Well, Scott's point, I think, is that there's autonomy, there's local autonomy, and there's egalitarian relations. I mean, in Zomia, he says in the Kachin, there are more egalitarian gender relations than anywhere else in the world. These are profoundly egalitarian societies, and they have existed for longer than the state societies, and they have persisted as a kind of like shadow and echo and mirror and alternative to the state societies for the whole endurance of civilizational forms. So what is it that exists in the hills? Smaller groups, egalitarian relations, refusal of hierarchy, and a set of techniques, economic techniques, but also political techniques that are specifically designed to avoid appropriation, to avoid a crop being seized, tax being seized, manpower being seized for labor and for the military, a set of techniques to avoid these things. And what do they consist in largely? The smallness of groups, non-hierarchy, and the capacity to break into tinier elements still and to disperse, the capacity to divide that ye be not conquered. These are acephalous societies. They don't have a head. And even when they have a head, if you look closely, a chief or something, it usually turns out that that chief was appointed by outside powers. And if it wasn't, the chief might have no real power. And if the chief is really respected, then the chief is going to be serving functions that are dictated by the society. And there will be traditions, and we'll see this in multiple instances, traditions of killing anybody who gets ideas about controlling everybody else. So this is a radically different tradition. So the point of bringing all this stuff up right now is to recontextualize this classical tradition and say, like, no. The classical tradition is a moment, is a local phenomenon inside a broader field of phenomena. And what we really want to look at is this broader field of phenomena as we go about asking the questions, what is possible politically? What is desirable politically for us? What are the social structures and the social organizations which we should choose, right? And what are the models that we can look at? So when we look even at ancient Greece, we will look not only at Plato and Aristotle and the historical formation of the so-called democracy, the limited democracy which existed in Athens, for example. We will look not only at those things, but also at, say, like the Dionysian sect within Greek society itself, which was heterodox, which was oriented towards a foreign culture, an Eastern culture, which put women in positions of power, which involved the falling away of all rank. There have been these heterodox sects for the history of Orthodox religions. So, you know, Scott mentions the dervishes, ecstatic groups often have mechanisms in place which prevent the emergence of hierarchical structures and at the same time prevent the incorporation of these heterodox groups into larger scale systems of control. So the general point of these texts today, I mean, you can go look at the details and they are cool details if you ask me. I mean, the second text in particular is relatively dense, but I want you to get general things from these texts. Like, okay, if we're thinking this way, if we're thinking about long history, and if we're thinking not only about the states, but what's outside the states in the hills, then what we can say about human communities and about forms of democratic governance expands massively.